Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of July. Senator Barack Obama gave a speech on faith-based programs this Tuesday, I believe it was, praising the president's Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, but saying that it never fulfilled its promise because the administration consistently underfunded social service programs for the poor. He said that he would replace the Bush program with a Council for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, and we'll talk more about what he said during this speech this particular program would do. Obama said that social service programs for the poor have been consistently underfunded and anticipating, which he has received in full measure, criticism from the left. The Democratic nominee for the presidency said, "I believe deeply in the separation of church and state, but I don't believe the partnership will endanger that idea so long as we follow a few basic principles." And we'll talk about those principles during this hour as well. We have two guests with us, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Professor Mark Silk is with us. Professor Silk is a professor of religion and public life at Trinity College, director of Trinity's program on public values, editor of Religion and the News, author of Spiritual Politics, Religion in America Since World War II, and Unsecular Media, Making News of Religion in America. He's co-author of the forthcoming, if it hasn't already been published, One Nation Divisible, Religion and Region in America Today. And he is with us, and we thank you so much, Professor Mark Silk, for joining us for this, what I'm sure will be very interesting conversation. Thank you.
Delighted to be here, Kathleen.
Also, Professor Kenneth Ward, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida, who's written about the relationship of religion and politics in this country, Great Britain, and Israel. Most recent books include Religion and Politics in the United States, The Politics of Cultural Differences, Social Change and Voter Mobilization Strategies in the Post-New Deal Period. He's been a Fulbright professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and in many other places in the world, actually. And we thank you, Professor Wald, very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, and also to share the mic with Mark.
Yeah, hi, Ken.
Hey.
Oh, you know each other. Oh, that's good. I'll make it.
It's a small world.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Were you surprised that Obama laid out this plan for a Council for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships that he took up? It would be changed, but that he took up on President Bush's program? Professor Silk, you want to start?
I'm not surprised. What surprised me was the initial report, which turned out to be mistaken, from AP, suggesting that he was going to find ways to allow faith-based social service providers to avoid the non-discrimination rules. Mm. That's been the big sticking point with the Bush proposal, and the idea that he would have sort of gone with that after having, been pretty careful about emphasizing separation of church and state. That was a surprise. But when he really emphasized the importance of maintaining that and annoyed some conservatives in the process while moving in the other direction, I thought it was a pretty effective and in line with his sort of community organizing background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it made sense both strategically and personally. Strategically, Senator Obama is in the position of defining himself for the American people and trying to define himself as someone who's squarely in the American tradition and relying on religious institutions to provide important social services is, I think, one of those policies that reinforces that kind of centrist image. And then, as Mark noted, Senator Obama's personal background in community organizing would have brought him directly in contact with the extraordinarily important role that urban churches have been playing in community development and redevelopment. So I think for both of those reasons, his embrace of it is very consistent with the kinds of positions he's taken.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it new, though? I guess I don't know the history here. Wasn't it new for President Bush to give government money to churches in this country to do various social service programs? Was that a change, or what is this tradition?
Well, the tradition is pretty old.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I think you're going to find a fair amount of agreement on this. But some of the biggest social service providers in the nonprofit area have been faith-based: Jack Catholic Charities, Lutheran Family Services, which both very active in a place like Wisconsin. What was the departure? I think Ken, you may disagree, but was the president's interest in sort of pushing that down to the congregational level, particularly among evangelical churches, and liking certain kinds of ministries, such as drug treatment, which, you know, took people off drugs by bringing them to Christ, and thinking that that was a way for the public to get involved. And that, I think, is sort of where the issue and the problems arose.
Mm-hmm. Right. Bush really differed not in, you know, certainly there was a more organized effort to encourage religious groups to bid for contracts, but this sort of contracting out has been going on for decades. The real difference is the principles that governed this contracting, and it's clear that Bush's effort was part of a larger political motivation to reward his supporters. Both John DiIulio, who was the founding mm-hmm. director of the White House Faith-Based Initiative, and David Kuo, who was the assistant director, in their memoirs, both acknowledged that the program was not really seriously an attempt to get churches involved as much as it was an attempt to essentially reward good supporters by relaxing the requirements that had strengthened the separation of religion and state. And those are the principles that that I think are critical. That's really the devil in the details, where Bush fundamentally altered the pattern.
Right. And DiIulio said, and tell me if this is something that you agree with, that the White House support for the program, Bush's support, was driven by swing state politics, he said, than by compassion for the needy. That's a pretty harsh statement.
Well, you know, I'm a little more charitable on this than maybe some people are. Maybe in the post-Quo era, we shouldn't be charitable at all. But I do think that the president, particularly in the sort of small pre-9/11 portion of his presidency, liked this approach a lot. You know, he'd had his personal demons to deal with in terms of, you know, alcohol abuse, I suppose, I think there was a serious commitment on his part, or an interest in trying to make this work and be the sort of touchstone of his compassionate conservative image. And I think it got sort of taken over, and his maybe the worser angels of his nature took over as well. But I don't think it was purely cynical from the get-go. I don't know. Do you disagree, Ken?
No, I really don't. And I mean, I think that there was a genuine perception that religious institutions do a better job of delivering social services than secular ones do. I hasten to point out there's no evidence that supports that argument, but it's at least a position that people can hold. And I think there was some sincere sense that this is a better way to address social problems. But I agree with Mark that this initiative was largely hijacked, and as spending for social services declined more generally, it really was a victim of all that.
And what about Obama? Could he be accused of coming up with this kind of policy for purely political reasons?
Well, I mean, I as I said, I think, you know, I'm not surprised when candidates for presidents factor strategic interests into their policy preferences. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'd kind of worry more if they didn't than if they did. So I have no doubt, as I said, this is part of his effort to bring him back to the mainstream and define him that way for voters who don't know him. Traditionally, you know, as we say, Democrats run left in the primaries and have to run to the center in the general, and Republicans have the opposite kind of pattern. So I think there's no doubt that there's some strategic value, but I think it's also risky. I mean, as I think some of the concern we've heard among people on the left about this, who do worry about the extent to which you can give money to churches without them in somehow, you know, violating the separation of religion and state, or conversely, without in some ways being implicated by decisions of the state, is genuine. So it's a strategic decision, but it's not without some risk.
Yeah,
I'd only add to that, Kathleen, that it seems to me that if you put together the speech on religion and faith-based programming with his speech yesterday in Colorado Springs on volunteerism and service, you know, you see the heart of the
right.
Obama emotional and, you know, sort of motivational campaign for the general election. That this is part of a kind of Kennedy-esque "ask not what your country can do for you" moment for him in an age which is, I would say, a bit more faith-based and less government-centric than 1960.
That's interesting. But he couldn't he have gotten by and wouldn't have incurred as much of the wrath that he got. And well, not wrath, but criticism from the left on separation of government and religion if he had just, you know, skipped the program, skipped the endorsement of federal funds for religious institutions who are doing service work and just gone with a volunteer and service government program.
Well, he wants to appeal to religious folks, but I'd say the criticism from the left is pretty muted. I mean, Barry Lynn is always prepared, to, you know,
yes.
from Americans United, is always prepared to jump up and down. And while he, you know, said that he would like to see the whole thing just jettisoned, you know, the separationist language that Obama had there was well attuned to his concerns and the concerns of a lot of people. So I don't think the left is going to make much of a fuss about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my sense is that what people on the left wanted was clarification about the policies that would govern the allocation of these funds, and that once that becomes clear, the issue is not going to be as dangerous. There's you know, some sort of reflexive concern about this, and I think it's particularly strong in the Jewish community. But again, I think there's a willingness to hear what Obama has to say, and that clearly, you know, most, you know, major religious providers do compete for these funds, so it's simply a reality on the ground.
Right. So how is this thing going to work? If you are, and he's very concerned about education of young people, he wants a great deal of money to go into that particular kind of program. How do you do this? Does the government, if he should win, does his administration set what the priorities should be for social service programs and then find out what faith-based organization is working in that realm, or do they present their ideas to him, or how does it work?
Well, I don't think that this is a huge initiative. I mean, he did talk about $500 million, $500 million for to do summer programming for 1 million kids. That's going to require some more funds than that. But the bulk of what he proposed, and, you know, we could come back to that, but the bulk of what he proposed had to do really with training of people and evaluation, which is something that's been very important to people who, as Ken pointed out, you know, really feel as if the evidence on the superiority, alleged superiority of faith-based providers is, you know, sort of non-existent. So, you know, I think what he seems to me to want to do, at least in part, is to integrate congregations, smaller grassroots organizations, the kinds that he was doing, into the larger web of nonprofit providers.
Uh-huh.
He talks about having Catholic charities, you know, groups like this that have been in the field for so long, be involved in training and working with smaller group. But that to me is actually a sort of an interesting idea, because what happened with the Bush initiative was that there was all this talk about, you know, faith-based providers, but there was no new money, and what the big providers immediately recognized was that this was a zero-sum game, and any money that went to these new small providers was going to come out of their hide.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little more detail. Oh, actually, we need to pause for a moment, and then we'll talk in more detail about some of these basic principles that he talked about to calm fears that this was infringing on separation of church and state. And we'll welcome your phone calls as well. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. On Tuesday of this week, Senator Barack Obama said that he thought that President Bush's faith-based program was a photo op, and he would scrap that office, but create a new council for faith-based and neighborhood partnerships that would be a critical, he said, part of his administration. He talked about the separation of church and state, and that people might worry about that with this program, but this partnership, he believed, would not endanger that idea as long as a few basic principles were followed. So, to your phone calls in a moment, we're happy to have as our guest Professor Kenneth Wald, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida, and Professor Mark Silk, who is a Professor of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College and Director of Trinity's Program on Public Values. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee, or email us at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR. Gentlemen, before we go to phone calls, Senator Obama talked about if you get a federal grant, you can't use that money to proselytize to the people you help. You can't discriminate against them or against the people you hire on the basis of religion, and the money that goes to religious groups can only be used on secular programs. Is that a radical departure from President Bush's faith-based program?
That's essentially a restoration of the regulations that were in place before Bush attempted to alter them. So, yes, that is really a return to what had been the norm. Typically, most of the major players in this area have created separate organizations to engage in this kind of work. Those organizations are staffed by professionals without particular regard to their religious background. They, as a condition of grants, have to serve everybody, and they have to refrain from any proselytizing. And they tend to be, you know, very professional social service organizations that resemble in many ways their secular counterparts. Bush clearly was aiming at a different kind of program, and again, focusing much more on individual congregations, which don't have that kind of history of separation of you know, their religious mission from their social service mission.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to go on with that, Mark?
No, okay. That's an admirable summary.
All right, thanks. Dan from White Lake is our first caller, gentlemen. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Hi.
I think the point that is being missed here is that money is fungible, and if faith-based organizations are furnished with government funds to do anything, even if that means serving the poor, that enhances their ability to do their proselytizing with other funds collected privately. This reminds me of the flap, the poor understanding of the Constitution. The Constitution does not require us all to be atheists or agnostics, but in fact says Congress shall make no law respecting the institution of a religion or the free exercise thereof. And when Keith Ellison, for example, was elected a Democrat from the state of Minnesota and was a Muslim, a big furor went up about whether or not he could take his oath of office on the Quran, which was subsequently satisfied when he took his oath of office on a copy of the Quran retrieved from the library of Thomas Jefferson. Everybody failed to recognize that the sixth article of the Constitution prohibits any religious test for holding federal office in this country, and had he chosen to do so, he could have taken his oath of office on Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn.
Well, if I could just jump in here. I mean, that's a subsidiary point, but the fact is that all congressmen take their oaths of office, the official oaths of office, together without any Bibles, all in the well of the House. And what that commotion was about was the private ceremonies that have been sort of grown up in a, you know, by pious congresspeople who want to do that. But I think your other point about, you know, the way in which when you have faith-based providers even trying to more or less adhere to the traditional rules, providing services, that there is or can be a proselytizing element, you know, there's some truth to that. And if you're a real hardcore secularist, you know, you're entitled to feel that way. I think the problem is, and Ken may want to say something about this, is that historically it's just not been the way the United States has done business going way back into the 19th century, and the survival of religiously affiliated orphanages and family care and all a whole host of institutions have grown up, particularly incidentally in the Northeast and to some extent the Midwest, where this has just been part of the web of social services, and to try to unwind that is not easy and will mean that a lot of people won't be served. That's why the Great Society went to black churches in the inner cities as the functioning civil society organizations to try to help them. They set up their 501c3s to do elder housing and so on. And, you know, you could say, well, you know, this did help the churches and did look a bit like an establishment of religion, but that's the only way they could figure to skin the cat at the time. You know, so, I mean, there it is.
All right.
Let me play off that to just make one other point.
Sure.
Under the law, religiously affiliated service organizations are in the same category as other nonprofits. They're considered 501c3s. And consequently, we, in a sense, by granting those institutions, you know, in a sense, exemption from federal taxation or making them eligible to serve as contractors, you can argue it is an indirect kind of subsidy. But it's a subsidy that really goes beyond the churches, and it really endows all of civil society with some degree of encouragement. Now, I don't find that to be a direct violation of religion and state, provided these organizations in the delivery of those contracts address the needs they're supposed to address. I think the problem to me is when they use the money directly for proselytizing. I also worry more about programs, for example, let's take a fairly obscure program. We have federal funds available to restore historic buildings that have fallen into disrepair. There used to be a clear understanding that that money was not to be used to support religious institutions to rebuild churches, but under the Bush administration, that's precisely how the money was used, actually to restore the worship space on the ground that these were structures of historical importance. That strikes me as direct federal support for the central mission of a religious organization, and that I find problematic on First Amendment grounds. But I think that relying on other parties as service providers means that you're inevitably going to subsidize somebody in some indirect way, but I don't think it's a kind of subsidy that really crosses the threshold.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Dan, for your call. How are you going to make sure, though, that all of these principles are adhered to, that the people you hire are not discriminated against on the basis of their religion, that the money's going to only to secular programs? Don't you need an oversight body to do all of that?
No. I mean, you know, there's always going to be some slippage, and you know, you have to sort of say, well, you know, if we're not going to run all after school programs, you know, with some state agency, if we're not going to run all social service providers with some, you know, public institution, which we haven't been doing, in fact, ever in this country, then, you know, you're going to have people who are not officials of the state in the normal sense or in the European sense, you know, who are working with people. But you know, I think the difference between recognizing that there's going to be, you know, some people who witness to somebody in a soup kitchen versus official policy from Washington saying, you can make ministry, you know, sort of a component of your treatment program, is huge. And the practice, as Kent pointed out, of organizations like Catholic Charities, Lutheran Family Services, and so on, you know, has been really to provide services in a pretty secular way. This drives some people crazy, but it should satisfy the church-state or religion-state separationist mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example.
Sure.
In my course on religion and politics, I typically bring in a panel of people from our metropolitan area who provide social services. Typically, these have to do with housing for the homeless, for temporary funding for people who've lost their jobs, soup kitchens and the like. And it happens they are all religiously affiliated and religiously based. And I always ask them as part of the panel how they feel about getting federal money for what they would do. And their position is, well, you know, it would be nice if they could get federal money to produce a building in which all of these various religious organizations could centralize their services, so you didn't have to go to one place mm-hmm. to get temporary aid for homelessness and another for, you know, food banks and that sort of thing. It would make it easier for their clients if there were one location. That's about the only kind of federal aid that they're interested in. These are not organizations that really have the technical capacity to administer large federal grants, and they're not sure that they're comfortable doing that, but they really want something that is fundamentally infrastructure for social service development. Most of these are lay people. They're not professional clergy. They're many of them are, in fact, not of the religious organization in whose names they serve. And I think that's probably closer to the reality of service delivery than some of the concerns that Dan might have felt.
Right. Let's go to Joe from Wausau next. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I was just calling because I'm one of those people who am really furious with the influx of Christian values into the government. But I would be totally supportive of this, given one major condition on both the government and the religious affiliation end, and that be that neither can discriminate. The government can't discriminate what religions they give the money to. The religions can't discriminate who they service. So a Christian organization would have to be able to serve Muslims, Jews, atheists, as well as, say, homosexuals and other people that they may turn away if they have privately organized the money. But if you are taking money from all of us, then you should be spending the money on all of us. And I think it's as simple as that. Also, I think that if they are taking government money, they shouldn't be using the money to promote their religious values on the people that they're treating. They can offer it, but they shouldn't require them to take on their values to receive the treatment, basically because it's a social program and everybody is entitled to use a program funded by the government. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's my comment.
Okay, thanks so much, Joe, for your call.
Well, I don't think Joe's going to get much disagreement from us on those principles. One of the real sticking points here, though, has to do with you know agencies that are religiously motivated being very happy to serve just anybody and bring them to their religious tradition. So so that's been a concern. One of the early approaches to this whole issue was that if you have a faith-based provider, you also have to have a secular provider. But those rules, how close the provider has to be, if it's the drug treatment program 2 blocks away versus the secular one that's a mile and a half away, that might be a problem. So there are cans of worms that all of this opens up.
Yeah, I think Joe did, though, accurately describe the law and the regulations as they existed prior to the Bush initiative. And even formal attempts to get rid of the non-discrimination thing were not successful. So the principle that Joe talks about remains enshrined. I think you're going to see a much more wholehearted embrace of it. And the real question is, can you simultaneously do that and get some of the smaller churches, black, white, particularly evangelical, who have not had the kind of technical capacity to deliver these services of the big players, to participate with those constraints. Now, I think if you look at the history of the black church in America, it has been comfortable accepting those rules. If you look at, for example, the housing sector in New York City, just to take one example, where the churches really were among the key agents of revitalization and reclaiming properties, rebuilding them, restoring them, and managing them in a way that seems to everybody, I think, to reflect the best of religious values without being sectarian, I think you'd be optimistic. Whether other churches can do that effectively, I think, remains to be seen. It is, from their perspective, it's a difficult thing when you say, keep your religious values out of this. That can be interpreted in one way as saying that what you're doing is simply based on technical, rational criteria, and I think the people in the churches would justifiably say that's not who we are. We're doing this because we have a deep religious commitment to providing, clothing for the naked, housing for the poor, and so forth. And I think for some of those churches, it's a difficult balancing act. And I think, again, you hope that good sense prevails and people will be properly trained about what is and isn't consistent with the policy that Joe talked about.
And what if it isn't? Then you cut off their funds.
Well, you do have to. There have been lawsuits involving some organizations, prison ministries, and so on, precisely on these grounds. One thing that I think I've always regarded as an important issue here that tends to get lost, is really a theological one. Traditional Catholic social services, charity, and this goes for other groups as well, the spiritual benefits accrue to the people who are providing it. We are, given a responsibility. Muslims are responsible for giving charity, for doing it. And so when you do these good works, it's your own spiritual benefit. And, you know, the difference is for evangelicals, they see the benefits of social service work as accruing to the recipients and feel very strongly that, you know, what they can really do, I mean, more important than getting them off drugs or getting them to be able to read better or whatever, is bringing them to Christ. And that's where you have a problem. Nobody has a problem with, you know, somebody saying, you know, I've got to do all this for the poor because it's a mission that I have and it makes me a better Christian. Say, fine, do it for whatever reason.
Sure.
Somebody else can do it. But if you're impelled as part of your understanding of service in the world to preach the gospel, then we have a religion and state problem. And in a lot of ways, it seems to me, it's been the sort of move to try to involve evangelicals, and particularly white evangelicals, in the whole service, social service movement that lies, you know, sort of behind the problems that we've seen with the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Ron from Abrams next. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. On this issue of church and state, I think Bush has made a shambles of that by all the time that he has spent with the particular people from Rome, from the Vatican. He threw the biggest party there was ever given for the Pope when he was here. Who paid for all that? Did the government pay for it, or did the Pope pay for it? Who paid for that? Did that come out of our money? Is that a separation of church and state?
Well, of course, the Pope is the head of a
right.
Of a country. I expect that we did pay for some of the welcoming ceremonies.
And thanks for your call. Let's go to Lori next. Hi, Lori.
Good morning.
Hi.
Out in western Wisconsin, a lot of the assisted living facilities and nursing homes and some of the hospitals have religious affiliations, mostly Protestant, Lutheran. My husband works for one. He's a direct caregiver, and he doesn't have a degree. He's not a nurse. He's not a CNA, and his wages are horrible. Approaching $8 an hour, there's no benefits, even though he works nearly full-time. I'm wondering if some of this money could be funneled to take care of the direct line workers out here.
What do you think, Ken? I mean, I don't think that Obama's proposing those kinds of, money for helping to pay providers a decent wage, but it does seem to me like, this is one of the ways that we get social services done, basically by having, faith-based nonprofits exploiting workers out of their own commitment to do needed social service.
Well, I think, my sense is that this certainly is a problem, but it's this problem across the board. The wages that we provide people in everything from, daycare through assisted living and
right.
the like are well below what one needs to support a family on a single income, and that I think this is a larger problem for American society to confront. Are we willing to accept that if we're going to have decent social services, we have to actually pay taxes? I know in my own state of Florida, we assert a lot of individual rights and programs, but you'll find that almost invariably those programs are oversubscribed and there are long waiting lists for almost every sort of state program that exists to provide for human needs. And we're so under the spell of cutting taxes that we've lost sight of the service problems that develop as a consequence of all that. So I think this is a real problem, but it's a problem that goes well beyond this particular initiative. I don't think, I have to tell Lori that one of the general rules that tends to operate in these things is that you cannot use federal money to pay the salaries of ordinary workers. There's some notion that each of these institutions has to provide its own basic support, its own infrastructure, and that the federal money tends to be used for particular initiatives and programs. So I don't think it's likely that the money will go toward salaries for long-established reasons. But I think you've identified just a huge problem that one hopes the new president, the next president, will address.
Right. Thanks very much for the call. What about funding for this program? Where is the money going to come from?
Well, if you look at the speech that Obama gave, it unfortunately, sort of has recourse to the oldest campaign the trick in the book when it comes to, you know, how are you going to fund programs? You know, they're going to, it's going to be solved by getting rid of, you know, waste in government.
Yeah.
So I think they just elided that question as perhaps the most charitable thing I'd say about that.
Mohammed is next from Madison. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my
call.
Yeah, I don't think this is new. I mean, if you've heard of Catholic and Lutheran social services and even some Jewish organizations, even before faith-based initiatives came into being, were receiving some federal dollars, they just had to come under the same standards and criteria as other non-government or community-based organizations. I think the problem that Senator Obama wanted to try to avoid, and I think he will if he's elected president, I don't know if any of you saw this report that Brian Ross from ABC did about a week or two ago, wherein he showed that for example, the Office of Juvenile Justice, I think it's called, was receiving some of these dollars, and instead of in terms of the grading system of the proposals, who should have received it, which would have meant the highest would most likely receive the money, the lowest would either receive the lowest or none. In this case, almost all of the organizations, for example, Cal Ripken, received $500,000 to run what basically amounted to a baseball camp for inner-city children, and was graded as one of the lowest. One of the highest, an organization in the Bay Area who deals with mostly African-American juvenile offenders, received none of this money. So I think, you know, to have some fairness and balance, you know, in this process is what most people will be looking for, which has not occurred in some cases under the Bush administration.
Well, I think your point is a very good one, that in general, in allocations, the decision should be made on objective criteria that have to do with, you know, the scope of the services provided, the efficiency, the track record of the provider, and so forth and so on. And then one would hope that political considerations don't play a large role. I think there is a particular danger when you have religious providers in the mix that decision makers will, in fact, bring into the mix their own attitudes toward those religious groups. When you do large public opinion polls of the American public and ask them questions about faith-based providers, they're very enthusiastic. They think it's a wonderful idea. They think we ought to be doing more of it. Then you start asking them about if certain groups who submit proposals should be considered, and what you discover is people bring their own religious preferences and prejudices into the mix. Far fewer would, for example, be comfortable with a mosque supporting programs than they would be with a Methodist church. And so the question is, if those kinds of considerations enter in, and you'll never take the entirely out of this process, but one hopes there'll be, again, professionals making these decisions based on appropriate criteria.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. We need to pause for a moment. We'll return and take more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. We're talking about Senator Obama's proposal for a new council for faith-based and neighborhood partnerships. He announced this a couple days ago. There's been some criticism from the left, with Obama saying that he believes in the separation, deeply believes in the separation of church and state. He doesn't believe that the partnership that he has proposed would endanger that idea. What do you think? We welcome your phone calls for our guests, and we have two distinguished guests with us this hour. Professor Mark Silk, Professor of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College, Director of the Trinity College Program on Public Values, Editor of Religion in the News, and his accomplishments go on. Professor Kenneth Wald, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida, who's written about the relationship of religion and politics in the U.S., Great Britain, and Israel. And both of them have written a number of books. And we'll take more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. David from Wisconsin Rapids is next. Hello, David.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guests. I appreciate this opportunity. As a person who was raised as a Christian but who no longer subscribes to the faith, I found that I was a little bit surprised when I heard about this that I was in kind of in favor of it, and I surprised myself there. Most everyone who is near and dear to me are Christians, and so I see that side of it. But a concern that I have, first I'd like to second the comments of Muhammad just earlier. I know that I had some suspicions about the program as it was run by this administration because they've politicized almost everything that they've done in government, including proselytizing that was going on at the Air Force Academy. So I had concerns about that. But more to the point, religious organizations do this as a service to people, but also as a service to their God. And part of that, part of their belief is that they sacrifice to do things for the poor and the homeless and the needy and so forth. And that's the part of Christianity that I admire. It seems to me, though, that it would be important for people who are taking, accepting these government funds, should have at least some requirement to do some matching fund, some fundraising through corporate entities or local businesses or fraternal groups or people like that, and of course their own membership, tithing of their own membership to make it. I don't want to use the term. It makes it too easy if they get it, get all their money from the government. But there should be some obligation on their part to kind of maybe put their money where their mouth is a good way to put it. So I'd be interested in
yes.
the comments of your guests.
Thank you so much for your call, David.
Well, I think there's every indication that, you know, not only does that happen, but that's certainly what Obama has in mind, talking about building capacity. But, you know, there's an awful lot of one of the things that we do know a lot about, particularly as a result of these initiatives, is there's been a huge amount of study of what congregations do in the way of social services. And, you know, many, many, many congregations have social services, but they do tend to be sort of short hit, you know, volunteer efforts at the local soup kitchen and things like that. And one of the issues here is, you know, what's the package of resources that go towards creating some kind of more permanent program. And that will be public-private partnerships. I mean, there are critics of public-private partnerships as they go on, but I think Senator Obama is not one of them.
And we go next to Jeff from Jefferson. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Well, this kind of worries me a little bit because we already have a system of enforced charity now. Those people that benefit from services typically aren't the ones that pay into it, and those that pay in typically do not benefit from those services. And now, what are we saying? The government doesn't have enough money, so now we need to tap the private sector as well. Christians typically give voluntarily and readily. I don't see a need for a partnership between government and the private sector. That just bothers me.
All right. Thanks, Jeff, for the call. Whoever wants to take it, Mark, Ken?
Well, I'll just point out there's very compelling evidence that the vast majority of people who receive assistance, whether it's from, you know, government contractors or directly from, you know, public institutions, are working poor. So they are people who do work, who do pay taxes, both at the federal level and, of course, at the state level through sales taxes and the like. So I'd have to disagree with one of the assumptions of the question. But realistically, again, if you're going to require faith-based providers to partially fund what they do through private donations, then you have to do that with all nonprofit or, for that matter, profit-making institutions that provide contracting services. And, of course, contracting of services is not unique to social services. We do it at the military level. We do it at others. I think you have to be careful that you don't set up requirements that are uniquely likely to affect religious providers, because that is also a form of discrimination. And so I would be, while I understand you want to see the providers themselves making some effort out of their own resources, I think that happens on a very wide sphere. But you have to also not balance the playing field against faith-based providers. They need a level playing field, and I think that's what Senator Obama was calling for.
Mm-hmm. Mark,
one of the things to stress here or to emphasize, because it's, you know, when you have a presidential candidate or a president talking about stuff, is, you know, there tends to be you tend to think, well, this is stuff that's coming from Washington directly. Most government funding of on-the-ground services comes via state and local agencies that may get money in the form of grants from the federal government or from the state, but then, you know, have their own rules and approaches to passing it through. So, this tends to be this kind of operation tends to be something that really takes place in terms of decision making pretty close to the ground, and there's just a huge and complicated infrastructure of organizations that have all their relationships, and one of the things that really remains to be seen is how all that plays too. I think one thing one can say about Senator Obama is that as a result of spending the time he did in Chicago, he has probably as good a feel for the intricacies of these relationships as any presidential candidate we've had in a long time.
Right. And let's move to the broader issue of people of faith in this particular election. Certainly much was made of the primary of where the Catholic vote is going. Much was made in the last election of where evangelical vote is going. Can you see another election where that's going to be a huge issue for both of these candidates, that Obama needs to and will be helped with this kind of proposal by getting voters in the Catholic community? What's McCain doing to get the evangelical vote, which is a base of the Republican Party, the role of all of this, or is it not as important?
Well, I think Mark and I will both have perhaps different takes on this. I mean, I think we would probably both agree that religion remains an important part of national identity in the United States. And as such, it's inevitable that it will be a factor in the electoral process. It's been the case that there have been some broad generalizations made about different religious communities, which often, I think, lack the nuance and miss some of the variability that occurs within those communities. But with all that being said, my sense is we're going to see the continuation of this pattern. You're going to see, I think, much more overtly a struggle within white evangelical Protestantism. Clearly, this has been one of the stories this year, that many of the younger white evangelicals are very uncomfortable with what they see as the, quote, Republican captivity of their religious community, and its single-minded embrace of a certain set of issues to the exclusion of issues having to do with the environment, global warming, social justice, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in a sense, there are elements of that constituency that are in play, to which Obama, I think, by virtue of his language, is very well equipped to appeal, to which, frankly, I don't think McCain is very, very rhetorically adept at kind of dealing with those sorts of concerns. Conversely, there's one very traditionally Democratic constituency, the Jewish community, whom some people see as nervous about Obama and more open than they've been in some time to Republican appeals. I don't think much of that argument, but one certainly hears it. And obviously Catholics have a variety of political orientations, being such a large community. So we're going to continue to see religious appeals. I think they're going to be more subtle and perhaps more sophisticated than they have been in the last couple of elections, but I don't see these things going away.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
I don't disagree with that at all. I do think that, Ken's point about the importance of seeing religious communities in their particular context, whether regional or state, matters a good deal. If you take Wisconsin itself with issues involving public funding of parochial schools and the Supreme mm-hmm. Court decision, and whether Catholics in Wisconsin might see this as a good thing, particularly since in places like Milwaukee you've got a large proportion of the students being served by Catholic parochial schools being non-Catholic inner city black kids. Those are all issues which are kind of on the table in one place that they may not be elsewhere. So I think, it's of course you know, the besetting sin of academics to talk about the importance of, you know, fine-grained nuance analysis and all the rest of it. But that is going to matter. And so, you know, you have to, we tend to think about states as the election gets closer as being critical. You know, how will Ohio go? How will Florida go? But then when the election's over, we want to say, well, Catholics all wanted this,
right,
and Americans all wanted that.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
And thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Professor Mark Silk, professor of religion and public life at Trinity College, director of the college program on public values, author of Spiritual Politics, Religion in America Since World War II, and Unsecular Media, Making News of Religion in America, co-author of the forthcoming book, which is titled One Nation, Indivisible, Religion and Region in America Today. Also, Professor Kenneth Wald, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida. His most recent books include Religion and Politics in the U.S., The Politics of Cultural Differences, Social Change and Voter Mobilization Strategies in the Post-New Deal Period. And thanks so much to John Anderson for producing the program, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, the 4th of July, have a wonderful 4th of July. I'll be with you again on Monday at 9 when we start the week, as we always do, with all things political. So stay tuned for that. Happy birthday to America. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.